Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dean Reuter, and it's my privilege and pleasure to welcome you on behalf of the Federalist Society to the third annual Executive Branch Review Conference. And welcome to those of you joining us on our live stream or watching a recording of our program. Today's proceedings have been organized by the Federalist Society's practice groups, and I want to begin by expressing my gratitude for all their hard work in putting today's event together. The goal of this year's conference is to consider very specifically the role of Congress vis-a-vis the administrative state. If the executive branch and the administrative agencies are exercising excessive powers, is Congress responding appropriately? Issues of delegation of power and congressional oversight will, of course, receive plenty of attention in our plenary sessions. More generally, though, we invite you to learn about whether limited constitutional government, the structural constitution, or even the rule of law have suffered in recent years or even decades as the power and breadth of the administrative state have expanded. This morning, we're joined by a distinguished gentleman who understands well the roles of Congress and the administrative state. As Justice Scalia often says, the length of one's introduction is inversely proportional to one's importance, so I shall endeavor to be brief in my introduction, and I shall succeed. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has served in the United States Senate since 1984. In his illustrious 31-year career, 31 years so far, he has stood undaunted before relentless infringements of congressional power from all directions. In the past few months alone, he's taken issue with EPA's Clean Power Plan rules, President Obama's executive action on immigration, and the president's negotiation with Iran, just to name a few issues. We're very pleased and proud that this longtime friend of the Federalist Society will offer this morning's opening remarks. We have him until about 9:25. With that, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Well, good morning, everyone. This is certainly a timely subject, given this administration's emphasis on regulatory activity. I think in looking back over the last 6.5 years, it's pretty clear the president concluded that the first 2 years he got most everything he wanted legislatively because he had 60 votes in the Senate and a 40-seat majority in the House. And even though he lost the House after 2010, he was undeterred in pursuing his objectives on the regulatory side. So let me begin with a simple proposition. Not every executive action is created equal, and neither is every congressional response. We all know that tensions between Congress and presidents over the limits of executive authority have been going on for as long as anyone can remember. But just because these debates aren't new, it doesn't mean they're not important. President Obama has tried to do a lot of things through executive action. And most of them, in my view, were bad ideas. But the things President Obama has tried to do fall along a spectrum. In some cases, what he's done is perfectly legal, if extremely ill-advised. These are the times when, however strongly we may disagree on the policy, we don't dispute his prerogative to pursue it. But we certainly intend to fight, oppose, or change it. In other cases, the president has scraped just against the edge of his authority, working within grayer areas of the law. And then there are the times President Obama and his administration have gone completely off the rails. Completely off the rails. The question in each of these instances is, what can or should Congress do about it? It's not a question that originated with this Congress or this president. It's not a question that will end with this Congress or this president. But President Obama's view of the extent of his own executive authority has brought renewed popular focus to an age-old and historically rather wonkish conundrum. Our founding fathers were wise to separate the federal government into three distinct branches with three distinct areas of authority. Now, I know I don't need to explain this to a room full of lawyers, but indulge me here just for a moment. The legislature makes the law, the executive implements the law, and the judiciary interprets the law. We all know that. These are things we all learned a long time ago, and I think we all learned about Congress' primary powers back then as well. So Congress has the power to fund, and it has the power to authorize. Congress also has the power to defund and the power to deauthorize. On paper, that's a lot of power, but of course the reality is rarely so simple. The most obvious challenge is one of numbers. I'd love to see Republicans have 60 votes in the Senate. In fact, if you go back to 1914, when senators were first popularly elected, my party has not had more than 55 senators in 100 years. So we've never had the hammerlock on Congress that our friends on the other side had during the New Deal, during the Great Society, and during the first 2 years of Barack Obama. Obviously, I'd be even more thrilled if we had a veto-proof number of Republican senators. But you got to work with the cards you've been dealt. The hand we've got today isn't a bad one. Now, we've got 54 cards, more than a full deck, but we don't have any Trump cards. The president has cards to play too, and more to the point, a pen to wield and a party to lead. And I always remind people there's only one person in the country out of 330 million Americans that can sign something into law and deliver the members of his party to vote for a deal that he makes. It's a heck of an important position. Vetoes are powerful, and political parties will do a lot to protect their leader, which usually does not mean joining the opposition to override vetoes. We all know a president is a formidable figure in our system of government. Formidable, but not invincible. It doesn't mean Congress is impotent in the face of overreach. It doesn't mean we can't push back either or even score some notable wins from time to time. We've done that historically. We are now. I'm sure we'll continue to do so in the future. The critical thing, in my view, is recognizing that the direct route isn't always the smartest or the most feasible. You've got to have the judgment to distinguish between policy overreach and legal overreach, and to pick the different strategies that will work best to get at each. You can't be afraid to take a hit or two in the short term if your real interest in getting the best outcome for the American people over the long run. You've also got to look at every tool you've got, including the less obvious ones. And so here are the five most important: authorizations, appropriations, political pressure and congressional oversight, the Congressional Review Act, and of course, the courts. Allow me to talk a bit more about each. Let's look first at authorizations. Congress has the power to authorize, and it's a straightforward power. Do this or don't do that. It's easy to understand. It's not always so easy for it to succeed, though, especially when it comes to imposing something on a willful president. It doesn't mean Congress can't, though, so here's a perfect example. Iran's pursuit of nuclear capability is one of the defining foreign policy challenges of our time, but the Obama administration never really wanted Congress to trouble itself with the matter. Move along, nothing to see here, they said. That was their view. John Kerry actually said, we ought to butt out. Here's a direct quote from him. What we're looking for here is not to have Congress interfere, he said, especially when it comes to the prerogatives of the executive department of the president. So he invited us out of this issue. So of course that made Congress all the more determined to interfere, as he might put it. I'd put it quite a different way. How about exercising our legitimate powers of oversight to ensure the administration can't impose a bad agreement on our country without a smidge of input from the American people and their representatives in Congress. That was our point of view. It's just common sense to give Congress more of a role in the process. Congress enacted the sanctions that most observers credit with bringing the Iranians to the negotiating table in the first place. And Congress should have a say in whether these sanctions are lifted. So we passed legislation to ensure we would have more of that role, and our Democratic friends finally decided that was important as well. It's tough to override a veto or get a president's partisan backers to vote with you against the leader of their own party. Tough, but not impossible. And it ended up passing by an overwhelming veto-proof majority. The Obama administration had repeatedly threatened to veto what we were doing. But thanks to some skillful work behind the scenes, as I indicated, their Democratic friends decided, at least on that basic principle, they were going to make the president submit it to us. So the White House eventually had to make a huge climb down. The veto threat was dropped. The Obama administration even started trying to claim it really hadn't caved. I don't think anyone bought the spin, but the example is clear enough. The result is that, though through bipartisan legislation, Congress ensured a role for itself and the constituents who elected it in reviewing and passing judgment on whatever agreement the administration may ultimately secure with Iran. As I said before, I would have liked to have had a much stronger bill than we had, but this is the best outcome possible under the circumstances and represented a win for the ability of Congress to assert itself against a willful executive. So let's take a look at appropriations. That's an example of authorizing. Let's take a look at appropriations. The power of the purse is Congress' other big power. There are many opportunities throughout the appropriations process, whether in committee, drafting stage, or on the floor with an amendment, for members of Congress to write provisions into appropriation bills that either instruct the administration to do a certain thing or to prohibit it from doing things. Because these riders are often folded into larger pieces of must-pass legislation, they are more likely to secure a presidential signature, assuming you can get the bill to his desk. In fact, sometimes they may be the only way to get a president to sign something into law that would almost certainly be vetoed if it were out there on its own. Just look back to the very beginning of the Obama administration. On his first day in office, the president vowed to close the prison at Guantanamo, and he vowed to do it within a year. He failed to present any credible plan to do so, however. He still hasn't, by the way. That's why Congress used appropriation riders to prohibit him, A, from transferring foreign fighters detained at Guantanamo Bay into the United States, and B, from using any federal money to prepare facilities to house them on American soil. We continue to insert those restrictions today. You'll find them in the defense appropriation bill we're debating right now. So appropriations riders are the reasons we don't have foreign terrorists brought here to Guantanamo being housed down the street near your neighborhood. Appropriation riders are, however, no silver bullet. That's especially true when a president's party is willing to put everything on the line to protect a certain policy, like they did with President Obama's significant overreach on immigration. Democrats basically filibustered funding of the Department of Homeland Security for an entire month to defeat a single rider. What Democrats have since discovered they can't do, however, is filibuster a justice system that's determined to do its work. We've seen some positive signs from the courts already on this issue, and we'll continue to keep a close eye as events unfold. As you know, the justice system has at least halted temporarily the executive action the president took on that issue after last November's election. So let's take a look at another way to try to achieve your goal: political pressure and congressional oversight. Members of Congress have a platform. There are times when it's appropriate to use that platform, especially when your state is coming under attack. So I'll give you myself as an example. That's just what I've done. The Obama administration recently unveiled its plan to impose regressive energy regulations that won't have much of a meaningful impact on global climate, but will almost certainly have a huge, and is already having a huge, impact in my state. We've seen a lot of this kind of thing from the folks in the White House. They're never ones to let facts or compassion get in the way of a nice ideological plan that won't actually solve the problem it purports to address. Here's something else about this energy plan. It's also probably illegal. So I wrote to each governor to let them know the regulation calls for each state to submit a formal proposal to the federal government on how they plan to meet its onerous and probably illegal mandates. I told the governors that they had the option to wait a bit, at least until the courts have a chance to weigh in. That's probably the most reasonable approach to take when you have no idea whatsoever if a regulation is even legal, and when submitting a proposal could mean locking your state in and possibly putting at legal risk as well. So that's what I did. Hopefully, a bit of breathing space will give Congress a little more time to see what it might be able to do as well, and we're working toward that end currently. But the point is, voters have given us a platform. We have a responsibility, when it's prudent, to use that platform on their behalf. Bringing pressure and attention to an issue isn't a power that's spelled out in the Constitution, but it's an important tool. It's not all that different from Congress' power of oversight. It reminds you the difference that an opposition party with a foothold in Congress can make, even when it only controls a single chamber. Lois Lerner might not be a household name if not for congressional Republicans, after all. Committees have the power to subpoena, to investigate, and to shame. And let's not forget, shame can be a powerful weapon indeed. Combating overreach doesn't always mean fighting it at the back end. What you do to prevent it matters too. That's where shame helps. An administration is going to think twice about testing the limits of power if it thinks it might have to deal with Chuck Grassley later. Especially if it means the truth is likely to eventually come to light in an embarrassing way. So let's talk about another tool, the Congressional Review Act. There are many ways to shine a light on an administration that would rather everyone turned the other way. But sometimes you have to be willing to pursue a strategy that might look destined for failure in the short run. So let me explain what I mean. Congress can also assert itself by invoking the Congressional Review Act. Basically, it allows Congress to pass legislation to overturn a regulation passed by the administration. Now, it's tough to get a president to sign a measure that repeals the very thing he or she just imposed. It's not easy to override the veto either, but on occasion, CRA can succeed. It's especially helpful if the president who issued the regulations already left office, which is what happened around 2001. The Clinton administration issued some onerous regulations, went out of office, and the new Congress and new president did use the CRA, and I think it's probably the only time the CRA has been used successfully. So there are occasions when it can work. The president, of course, can veto the CRA. But even going through that exercise, as we have recently, even though you know it's going to be vetoed, is a way of highlighting congressional or administration overreach. We saw that with the Congress vote a few weeks ago to reject the Obama administration's attempts to completely upend a decade-long tradition of union elections. A clear majority in both houses rejected what the president was trying to do through his NLRB appointees. He, of course, vetoed the measure, but it helped bring needed public scrutiny to an issue that the administration would probably have preferred to ram through without anybody noticing. So this is another example of what I mean by keeping focused on the long game. What's seen as a defeat today might just be viewed as a temporary setback, even a tactical masterstroke in the long run. It all depends on how willing you are to take a few hits today for a better result tomorrow. Now, since we're on the topic of the NLRB, that takes us to the last point I'd like to make this morning, and that's about the courts. Back in 2012, President Obama decided he didn't want to take the chance that the Senate might not approve his picks to serve on the NLRB. Before the Senate, which was then controlled by his party, could even act on the nominations, he said that he refused to take no for an answer. So the president figured he'd simply decide for himself when we were in recess and then go ahead and put these guys in office as a recess appointment. In other words, he sought to establish that he got to decide whether or not we were in session. Well, the president doesn't get to decide when the Senate is or isn't in recess. The Senate does. The Senate gets to determine the rules of its own proceedings. In short, the president violated one provision of the Constitution, the Rules of Proceedings Clause, in order to avoid complying with another provision of the Constitution, the Advice and Consent Clause. In effect, what he did was try to claim to himself, as I indicated, the unilateral appointment power that the framers deliberately withheld from the office of the presidency. They were quite clear about it. That's why I was joined by 44 of my colleagues in challenging the president's action in the D.C. Circuit and the Supreme Court in the NLRB versus Noel Cannon case. Given our minority status in the Senate at the time, it was the best avenue available to remedy a pretty frightening show of executive overreach, and we worked it hard. We retained excellent counsel in Miguel Estrada, who many of you know, and it eventually made its way to the Supreme Court. May have been a little bit unorthodox, but in the end we won, and we won big. Every single justice on the Supreme Court decided with us, even justices the president himself had appointed, rejected that brazen power grab. It was about as clear a victory as we could have asked for, and for the sake of the Senate as an institution, no matter who serves here or what party takes the reins, I think it was a good thing. I know it was a principle worth defending. I'm pretty proud of it, and it serves to underscore the points I made earlier. The relationship between the executive and the legislature is always complicated. We're going to step on each other's toes sometimes, always have, and always will. But the question of how Congress should respond to an executive policy it doesn't like or an executive action it finds constitutionally objectionable is never that straightforward. Sometimes you're on offense, sometimes you're on defense. Sometimes you pre-butt, sometimes you react. Sometimes you have to be willing to take it on the chin in the service of a larger victory, and sometimes you have to think creatively about the best remedy in light of the circumstances. You're not going to win every fight. The founders never intended for one branch to come out on top in every battle. Even so, I'm still going to do everything I can to get the best deal possible for the Senate, for Congress, and for my personal perspective, at least, for the American people. Thank you very much. Yeah, let's take a couple. Take a couple of questions if you have.
Can you hand me that water over there?
Go ahead. Hi, I'm Roger Klein. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. And my question relates to a sort of a narrow issue. But so in the Congress, in the Energy and Commerce Committee, currently there is a bill that's being circulated, a draft bill, to regulate laboratory tests, to expand FDA's jurisdiction, to regulate clinical laboratory tests that are provided by academic medical centers throughout the country that are very, very important for precision medicine, for personalized medicine, for patient care, and for innovation. And I know the Senate Health Committee is also going to take up this issue. And I guess my question to you is, given the executive overreach that spans the government now, what's your response to the Republican Party going ahead and expanding FDA jurisdiction to cover to then oversee it and potentially shut off testing at academic medical centers in Kentucky and across the country?
Yeah, well, honestly, I don't know enough about that issue to be commenting on it. But what I can say is, if you look at the executive branch's approach to regulation, it's whether it's healthcare, financial services, EPA, NLRB, FCC, you name it, if you look at the overall approach of this administration, this is a very adversarial regulatory environment. Their view is if you're making a profit, you must be up to no good.
That's true.
And the business of making a profit in itself is inherently suspicious activity. And that is the reason I'm not addressing your question, because I don't know the I don't know enough about it to address it. But I do want to make a broad comment that this is the reason we're bumping along here with a 2% growth rate. The government itself is making it very difficult for our entrepreneurial country to do what it does best, which is to grow, create jobs and opportunity for our people. I do a lot of traveling around the country. I don't care what business you're in, the single biggest complaint is the adversarial regulatory environment. When the president came to office, he wouldn't put it this way, but he wanted to Europeanize America. They made a lot of progress. Big debts, high taxes, overregulation, slow growth, all the indices of a sick society, no matter how you measure it, they've created. And their solution? Well, we just haven't spent enough, you know? Or we haven't regulated enough. Or we haven't litigated enough. So, as I outlined here today, I mean, to ultimately get the country going again, we're going to need a different kind of chief executive in the White House. You know, somebody who has a very different view about what our country ought to be like. So the reason I'm making this point is, unfortunately, I've got to go, and I've got people standing up here who want to ask questions, but I can't stay. But I wanted to make that point before I left, because the fundamental problem we have in this country right now is the government itself. The government itself. And so next year is a very, very, you know, politicians always say this, but a very big election. Hillary Clinton and her team believe that America has moved left. She's not going to run as Bill, she's going to run as herself, which isn't going to be all that distinguishable from Elizabeth Warren. They're gambling that they've Europeanized America so much that they can actually run and win being themselves. What I think the key question is in the general election for whoever our nominee is to look out at the American people and ask the following question. If you're satisfied with where America is today, if you think this is as good as we can do, then she's your candidate. But if you think America's best days are still ahead of us, and we can do a lot better, taking a new direction, then I'm your guy. So whether it's the fact that they've taken over 8 of 11 circuit courts, they've done a lot of damage to the country. And so we are really at a crossroads here, my friends, in 2016. What are we going to be like? We want to be like France? Or we want to be like America? Thank you for the opportunity to be here.